just be made great.
Everybody, I'm Greg. I'm a compulsive eater.
Happy
to be here today. Thanks, John, for asking me. I'm going to do show and tell. I usually forget, but I was speaking at a Thursday morning meeting, so I left it in the car. So start from the back, from the cute little plague, and work towards the middle, and that's it in terms of my pictures, and then if you want to keep going, you can look at some places I've vacationed. In program. So that's all brand new from program. So let's see. I have no idea what I'm going to say, so I hope you get something out of it. And I'm just going to follow the typical format, which is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And tonight I'd like to focus more on between the what happened and what it's like now. Because what it was like is... it was bad. But... let me just say, first off, an old sponsor of mine said that whenever you speak, qualify just really briefly and give your stats. So I first came into the program in the summer of 1988. It was the first Wednesday in July. I was approximately 250 pounds, so that was about 18 and a half years ago now. I currently weigh, I have no idea what I weigh. And that right there is a miracle that I actually don't know what I weigh. And that I don't care enough to know what I weigh, but I'm going to guess that I'm about 190 based on the last time I weighed myself. So I've been as low as 165 in this program, and thankfully I've never gone higher than where I'm at. And so hopefully you'll hear a bit of my story. I also have relapse in my story, in that I came in 1988. I left in 94 for approximately a year, and I came back June 2nd, 1995. So I'm just almost 11 and a half. Years abstinent. And I'm really grateful for that, to abstinent and back from relapse. So, it's very interesting when you look at some of these pictures. When I first got some of the pictures of me from my parents prior to age six, I grew up basically, and I've spent all of my adult life thinking that I was fat for my entire life. Until I found this program. And there was a point prior to coming to program, it was probably in 87 or so, when I basically looked at myself in the mirror, which was a very loathsome, difficult thing to do. I hated looking at myself in the mirror, and I basically, I hated myself, pretty much, is what it came down to. I had the amazing mental capacity to block anything from my neck down, so I was not really conscious below my neck. And I think that's one of the sadder points of this disease, is that the lack of actual physical consciousness, like awareness of my body. So there was this point at which I just noticed, kind of, very momentarily, that I was fat, and I figured, I guess I'm going to be fat the rest of my life. And by then, I was definitely up to 250 pounds. My eating is not, I haven't historically been a binge eater. I was what I call a graze eater. You might have heard that term before. And basically what that meant is that once I started, I didn't stop. And I probably ate enough throughout the entire graze, as much as probably two or three sittings at a meal. And I also had the habit of having more than one meal at a meal. I guess you call that servings, but I had no idea what servings were back then. So I like to say that prior to coming in program, my life was very easy to describe. I basically, my life was controlled by fear, and then my attempts to control everything that I was afraid of, and to control whatever it was. In the beginning, it's very interesting because before age six, I was a slender kid, as you see in my pictures. I was a cute little tyke, and I was normal size. And I remember after getting into recovery, I asked my mom, like, was I always, fat? You know, like, what? Because I just, there wasn't any memory. And she goes, oh, you were always big boned. I'm like, I'm not big boned. I don't know, maybe my bones are shrunking program, but I doubt it. So, I took that as gospel, basically. I thought she was right. And to see those pictures, what I realized is that there was a certain point about what was going on there, but the why is really immaterial. The point is that at that point, I discovered that I didn't have to feel anything if I ate. Period. That's how it works for me. If I eat the wrong kinds of foods, or if I eat my trigger foods, my addiction foods, my alcoholic foods, then there is no such thing as a feeling. And in reality, what I've also learned is that there really is no such thing as a clear, conscious thought. Okay? Nor is there such a thing as inspiration or intuition or any kind of spiritual guidance of any form. Nor do I really give a shit what you have to think or say. Actually, I care a lot about what you have to say if I'm binging. I care a lot about what you think, but I don't give a shit what you say. You know, it's this weird... And the thing is I become incredibly fearful. So I spent the first 22 years of my life afraid of everybody. I could not have done something like this. I don't know how many people are here, but there's well over 20, and that would have petrified me. Why? Because I was self-conscious. I was afraid of what everybody thought. I was afraid of succeeding. I was afraid of failing. I was afraid of having sex. I was afraid of girls. I was afraid of dancing. I was afraid of not getting A's. I was afraid of getting D's. I was afraid of doing something wrong. I grew up really being told that I could not make a mistake. Not in the good sense. Like, oh, you're so great, you can't make a mistake. No, it was like mistakes were not allowed. And I had that message quite strongly when I got in. So fast forward a little bit through time, and I eventually, I don't think food was prevalent in my family, but it was not necessarily prevalent in my life. It definitely worked, but I wasn't conscious of how it shut my feelings off. And as things went on, as I got older, my eating became clearly robotic, to the point at which there was no thought really. It was like, feel something, eat, go to the fridge, get this, whatever. And even if I was in self-loathing at that moment, or knowing that I shouldn't have that extra scoop of ice cream, or, you know, knowing that I shouldn't eat the whole box of vanilla wafers, or whatever it was, I had no control over it. There was no power. And, you know, for me, the admission of powerlessness in the first step is really important, because once I admit that I'm powerless, and then once I come to believe in a power greater than myself in step two, and then once I turn my will and my life over to the care, not control, the care of a power greater than myself, then and only then do I actually have power. I get given the power of choice. If I choose the food, I then forfeit that power. I no longer have the power if I start eating my alcoholic foods. I give it up. So, just to describe some of my behaviors to you, when in college was pretty much the worst for me. What I would do was, of course, room and board was paid, right? So to me, cafeteria was free food. And I used to say there's two things in the world that you can't beat: an open bar and God. You know, I'd have to say a buffet as well. So the thing for me was that I got to a point of trying to control my food. So I would skip breakfast, and then I would think, I'm just going to have salads for lunch. And I would be starving. I'd be absolutely famished by the time I got to lunch. You know, I had gone through my classes or whatever it was. I'd have a salad, and then another. And then, you know, and then, or I would go in and I would have breakfast, and I would have the biggest, bulkiest breakfast. I mean, it just, and then I would think, I need to skip lunch, or I need to, like, have a really small lunch. It never worked. And I was so comfortable being in the cafeteria that I would go to dinner. Actually, at the time I was Catholic, I no longer am, but I would go to Mass at like 5 o'clock. It would finish, it was like super rapid Mass. It would finish at 5:30, and I'd go off to the cafeteria. I would have my meal. I would have my second meal, or my next half meal. I would wait until about 6:30 or 7 when the track team would come in, and they all looked like I do now. And they were spelt, athletic, they had just run 10 miles or more, they were like, totally had burned it all off, and they didn't have two or three helpings of things. And I felt right at home with them, and I had already had my food by the time they came in, so to actually see them doing it. But at the same time, I was jealous of them. I was completely envious of them, because they had the kind of body that I wanted, and they were able to people put away that food and it didn't even put an ounce on them. And so, and they were great guys as well. They were just really good-hearted people. And we would have a lot of fun, but I was like secretly envious of them, as well as also just honestly admiring them. Later on, after college, what I found was that I was constantly at the refrigerator. When I first got abstinent, I like to tell the refrigerator story, and getting abstinent was really challenging for me at first. So if anyone's having trouble, know that it's not necessarily about being struck abstinent. I like to say that in 1988, for the first time, I was struck willing. And then the second time was June 1st, 1995, and so that was the second time in my life in which I was struck willing. I wasn't struck abstinent. I was struck willing to do something about it. And that meant coming back to program. So when I first got into program in 88, I knew there were certain foods that I had problems with. I knew, right? We know. And the thing is like, I love it when somebody new comes in and they say, I just, I don't know about this thing called absence. And I'm like, what do I do about absence? I'm like, well, what do you have problems with? Like, that's, we know, right? So I knew one of the things was carbonated beverages, like soda, Coke, root beer. I'd go through a six-pack of root beer in an afternoon. And my parents were always amazed, like, where did all the Coke go? I was like, well, I don't know. But what I would do was, as I was starting to get abstinent, I would feel something, and I wouldn't recognize it right away. And next thing I know, I'd be at the refrigerator with the door open, hand on the handle, hand reaching in for a piece of food. And I would, by the grace of God, or I don't know what, I would stop, and I'd be like, okay, wait, I've made a commitment to abstinence. I've made a commitment. What does that mean to me? That means that before I can be abstinent, for me, I need to commit to feel my feelings no matter what, period. Because I recognized early on that I ate over my feelings. I ate to stuff them down. There was more stuff that I learned as I went on. There were spiritual components to that, but on a very pure, just the dynamic of it was, if Greg had a feeling, Greg ate. And it didn't matter what that feeling was. I could be like hot for somebody. I could be bored with something. I could be scared of something. I could be pissed at you, which was something that I even didn't register. Like, that, I was so fast into the food with that one because I didn't even know that feeling. So as time went on my first year, I would find myself at the fridge time and time again. It was at least the first couple months. But it was progressive. Again, another reason why I don't believe in being struck abstinent. I believe that because the disease is progressive, my recovery can be progressive as well. So this is an example of the progress that I made early on. I would find myself at the fridge, door open, hand on the handle, not reaching for food, but kind of staring in there longingly. And I'd be like, okay, I must be feeling something. What is it? And my very first sponsor taught me a very, very important tool that I usually pass on to my sponsees, and that is comfortable, uncomfortable. When it comes to feelings, it can be that simple. Am I comfortable or am I uncomfortable? And all that is because, see, I can get into like, oh, I don't know what I'm feeling. Well, I can't figure it out. Because there are so many feelings. Like today, I can really honestly say that I have a very rich emotional life. And I say it's rich because it doesn't matter if I'm pissed off, resentful, fearful, celebratory, horny, grateful, whatever it is. It's a rich emotional life, you know. I didn't have that when I was in the food, so I'm grateful for a rich emotional life. But I'd be standing there in front of the fridge, and I was noticing by my behavior that I was about to be compulsive. And by sitting in these rooms, people had taught me, your behavior is an indicator. Pay attention to that. And so there I was, and I was like, I'm about to be compulsive. Something must be going on. I didn't know what. So, of course, I would use the tool, comfortable, uncomfortable. Oh, I feel really uncomfortable right now. That was easy. I was like, it was so easy to do comfortable, uncomfortable, right? So if you need help learning your emotions, just stick with that. And then the cool thing about that was that it was really empowering for me. As soon as I said, wow, I'm feeling really uncomfortable, like, who the hell cares what it was? I was being honest about my emotions, probably for one of the first times in my life, and suddenly it was like, oh yeah, I'm being uncomfortable, I committed to feeling my feelings no matter what, let me take a moment, God please help me, whatever, serenity prayer, to figure out what this is. And when I would drill down on it, right, because I needed to start somewhere, when I would drill down on it, I would suddenly realize that 12 hours ago, somebody made some sort of comment about the job I had done at the office, and I misinterpreted it, or I whatever, or and that was quite often the case, was that it was well over several hours prior that something had happened. So I had this horrible lag time. I mean, sometimes it was days. It was like, oh, that person looked at me weird last week. You know, I mean, just, it was, you know, and so another piece of the progress was, next stage, maybe a couple months or a month or two later, I would be at the fridge, hand on the door, not door open, thinking about the food inside, wondering what I had in there, right? And then I'd realize, I'm feeling something, right? A month or two later, it was actually probably a period of a couple weeks, I think, but the next thing was outside the fridge, in front of the fridge, not touching it, pacing back and forth in front of it, going, I know that thing's in there, oh, I know they put that, you know, and that little devil and angel on your shoulder kind of thing, you know, and eventually, I got to the point where I'd be in some other room in the house, and I would think of the fridge, and I would go, I must be feeling something, right? So for me, I tell that story because I love how it shows the progression of recovery. And I also tell that story because I think it inspires and gives a lot of hope that you don't have to do it perfectly in the beginning. I sure as hell didn't. The very first thing I got abstinent from was Coke and Pepsi and root beer. And I wasn't really abstinent from anything else for 5 or 6 months after that. It was progressive, but then here's the next cool story. November 1988, I realized that after a couple months in program and a little bit of progress and a little bit of spiritual connection and everything, I thought, well, I better do what they're saying about getting a sponsor. I don't really want it, but you know, I finally became willing to get a sponsor. So I asked a guy, and he's like, "Oh, sure, I'd love to sponsor you. Here's my food plan." Because back in the day, basically, your sponsor gave you a food plan, right? It was right at the time when Gray Sheet was phasing out, and Gray Sheet was very strict, and it was very specific, and a lot of people had done it. But also, if people weren't doing it, there was still quite this habit. So, like, you get a sponsor, and you start doing exactly what they're doing. So, this one guy said, "Here's my food plan. I don't need any sugar. I don't need any white flour. And I weigh and measure my food." And I said, "Fuck you." In my head. You know, I was like, no freaking way. And I walked away from that, and I was like, okay, I'll call you. Yeah, right. So I didn't call him. And a couple weeks later, I thought, there's that nagging thought, I should get a sponsor. So I heard somebody else speak, and they raised their hand, and they said they were a sponsor. And I was like, oh, I'll ask him. So I asked him, he goes, "I would love to talk about that." And I'm like, "What's your food plan?" And he goes, "I don't need any sugar, I don't need white flour, and I weigh and measure my food." And I was like, not really for me. So I didn't call him. And then it was late November 1988, and I thought, I really need a sponsor. And I listened to how it says it in the tools, and it says, find somebody who has what you want. And the way it's really written, I don't know if they've rewritten it, but they didn't say, find a sponsor who has what you want. They said, find someone who has what you want. So I realized, oh, just because someone's not raising their hand doesn't mean I can't ask them. And so I heard this guy speak, and he talked about how he worked the steps and how he wrote over them, and he sounded serene. He sounded like he had perspective around his problems. He expressed himself in a way that he seemed to be happy with himself. He had physical recovery. He was married. He had a good job. He seemed like, wow, this is a lot of what I want. But he hadn't raised his hand. And I walked up to him later, and I said, "Are you sponsoring? I really need a sponsor." And he said, "Well, give me a call." So I called him, and we talked, and he said, "Here's my food plan. I don't need any sugar, I don't need any white flour, and I weigh and measure." And I said, okay. So there's a fine difference. I don't know what it is, but there's a fine difference between being willing and unwilling. And when I really am willing, then my recovery begins to happen. When I'm willing to feel my feelings no matter what, my recovery begins to happen, even if I'm in the food. I believe first in being clean from the food and then work in the program. That's my personal experience and my belief. But other people need to do it differently, and I respect and I honor that. For me, I needed to get clean with the food in order to open up to the possibilities of having a different life. And then this guy really helped me. He gave me an amazing first step, and I'll share this with you as well. So first step, we were admitted we were powerless over food and that our lives had become unmanageable. What does that look like? For me, he helped me by breaking it down into three lists. The first was all the foods, the specific substances that I ate compulsively. Right? And he was like, write it all out. I don't care if it's, you know, if it's pecan cookies and oatmeal raisin cookies, right? Cookies or write both of them, whatever, however specific you need it to be. If it's all kinds of ice cream except one brand, just write ice cream or whatever. You know, and it was like, so I had to write that list. And then the second list he had me write was all of my compulsive behaviors around food. Eating too quickly, eating seconds, eating thirds, eating while I was preparing, eating while I was walking, eating while I was driving, just all these different things. And the last was all the situations, scenarios, and feelings over which I ate compulsively. And that one was a doozy because family was on there, sexuality was on there, relationships, career, social situations, public speaking, whatever it could have been. There was, I mean, my whole life, basically, I could have listed my whole life in that one list. But the cool thing was that by the time I was done with that list, I was able to see my patterns with my sponsor's help. And that's really the key for me is in the beginning, is being able to see our patterns. Because then when I get up to step four, I've had a little practice looking at Greg's patterns in life. Because then at step four, I can start to take a look at my patterns of the way I think and the way I act, not just around food. You know, so for me, then the next step, step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I felt I did that step already, because I grew up Catholic, I was religious, I did a lot of activities, I was a good Catholic Christian boy, I went to church, I did my thing, and I was wrong about that. I did not, I believed in a power greater than myself, but I did not believe that that power could restore me to sanity. And I honestly didn't really necessarily think I was insane. I just was starting to get a grasp on the fact that I had a food problem. So for me, the beautiful thing about step two is that a couple years down the line, I decided to not be Catholic anymore. And that really threw me into a bit of a loop. But thanks to this program and a lot of other people's experience, that was the time at which I really embraced step three. It was about 3 years into being abstinent. And I embraced it because our literature, which had just come out at that time, and the AA literature was basically saying, I don't care what you believe in that thing that's greater. So I don't even care if you have a concept. Just believe in something and make sure it's bigger than you and not you, you know? And that was, for me, it was amazing because step two enabled me to let go of the higher power I grew up with and embrace, over the years, several other higher powers, or at least other concepts. They were all the same higher power to me, but it was like I could only grok a certain concept at a time. So at that time, I excommunicated myself from the Catholic Church, and I basically prayed to an oak tree outside my window. And about 6 months later, I decided to move to Philadelphia. I grew up in Rochester, New York, and I realized I can't take the oak tree with me. I'm going to need something else. So that's when I realized, well, I said to myself, when do I feel closest to anything that I could call a God? And I realized that whenever I was indulging in creativity, whenever I was engaged in creative process or doing something creative, I felt really close to something I could call God. So I made creativity my higher power. And it just blossomed from there. I ended up going and studying Buddhism for a few years. It's all progressed from there. I'm not currently religious in any way. I don't affiliate myself with anything except program and a particular dance practice that I do, which is also very spiritual for me. And that's the other thing. My whole ability to understand something greater than myself, my body is a power greater than myself. And that has come to me in the last 7 or 8 years in realizing, one, that I actually have a body, that I can pay attention to it more than just regarding what goes into it, you know, and that I actually can use it. And I can use it in ways that I was never able to at 250 pounds and that I really am now at 190. I can do push-ups. Oh my God. I could never do push-ups before. I was not only too scared of them, but I thought I was a wimp. I thought I was a weakling. I thought I was not strong at all. And now my body is now proving to me that it has more capacity than I even think it does, which is really amazing to me. So then let's move to step three. Like, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood him, or it. I don't think I necessarily struggled with this that much. I did struggle with the notion of letting something go that I was thinking about. That was really hard. What did it mean to let something go? And what I want to say about that is that, I was thinking of this earlier, and let me see if I can say this right. Acceptance is not resignation, and surrender is not giving up. And for me, that's really important to draw a fine line between those two things. I gave up so many times with the food. I gave in to the food prior to the program. I gave up on myself, I gave up on other people, and I gave up on life. And that's the same to me as resignation. It's like, oh, like I said earlier, I've resigned myself to being fat for the rest of my life. Okay, so now I'm not fat anymore, and I haven't been for years. So was maybe Greg's thinking not too good back then? You know, was like maybe the way I viewed things not quite right? So letting go of the way I was thinking about things kind of started with the willingness. And it wasn't giving up on something. Because, like, I'm the type of person that if something, back then, if something didn't work, I would either try harder or I would give up instead of try different or try to change my thinking around it, you know? And when I came into program, there were still a lot of things that I was afraid of, and I'm not afraid of those now, you know? I'm not afraid of women anymore. I was definitely afraid of women. Yeah, I was definitely afraid of women. They just made me panic to no end. You know, it was crazy. I was afraid of being successful. I was afraid of having a career. It was when I was almost 29 years old and I realized if I don't have a career, if I don't pick something, by the time I'm 30, I felt that I would never have a career. And I picked something, and it was the wrong something, and I switched and picked something else, and that worked for years. But it is like that fear kept me out of a career till I was 29. And like 29, that's like you're starting to become a spiritual adult, you know? That's late. It's late to pick a career. But I did. I picked one, and it worked out. And now, since then, like, I've done things that I could have never imagined. Because this program, through these steps, has afforded me a way to look at these fears and say, well, what's really going on here? Like, I was afraid to make money. You know, when I moved to Philadelphia, I was making $25,000 a year. Now, that may sound like a lot to some people, but that then, I mean, it was a lot to me back then, but it wasn't really very much to live on. I was still barely scraping by. And I thought to myself, wow, if I could make like $30,000, like, I mean, that's not a big jump these days. $5,000 is not a big jump. But back, at that time, in my mind, it was like the Grand Canyon. Size of a jump. And I got this job, and they gave me 35. And I thought, oh my God, I can make 35,000, maybe I can make 50, you know? And eventually, within about 2 years' time, as I became more comfortable in my profession and in my own skills, and I obviously grew in my recovery and my self-confidence around who I was, my knowledge of who I was with the steps, I was able to make more and more money. I've been able to start businesses, I've been able to lead businesses, I've been able to move. I've been able to do all these things that originally I was too afraid of. So, to me, how does that relate to step three? That relates to step three in that I'm not pushing anymore. I do push sometimes, but I can tell the difference now, actually on an emotional level. I know that if I want John to think a particular way about me, and I start acting a specific way, and I can feel this, like, pushing, you know? It's like a trying too hard kind of a thing. Whereas if I just kind of go, okay, God, I'm going to let you take care of this. I'll do whatever's in front of me, but I'll let you take care of the result, right? And for me, that, again, there's a difference between intention and control. My intention is to be the best person that I can be with the help of this program and my higher power. I can't always control that. I often can't control it at all. Nor can I ever, ever, ever control a result. But I can certainly intend one. There is no problem with me having a goal or having an intention. When I came in, I wanted to be thin. There's nothing wrong with wanting that. And I actually, what I did, part of my step three, was to commit to being abstinent. I said, I'm just going to be abstinent, and I'm going to trust that my higher power and my body will figure out my weight for me. You know? And I'm grateful for that happened, because otherwise, I would have tried to control it. And that's why eventually I let go of weighing and measuring. So step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. My first step four was like a mini novel. It was just not very rewarding. It was simply regurgitation to please the people that I was first, I mean, the first four step with, you know. But then about 2 years later, it was 1990, I was really feeling like, I keep doing the same things. I keep thinking the same things. I'm tripping over the same stuff in my head. I keep exhibiting the same behaviors. I really want some freedom around this. And so I got some sort of 95 question thing from AA, and I just answered every single one of these questions. And I sat with this really compassionate, loving man that I knew at the time. He was not in OA, but I trusted him. I felt comfortable with him. And I sat with him on the 4th of July, 4th of July, 1990, I think it was, or 1989. And I basically bared my soul to him. And I never before had told secrets, you know, things that had happened to me, things that I was embarrassed about or ashamed about or felt guilty about. I'd never told them as honestly as I told him. And this, to me, is the power of the fourth step. At the time, that, you know, I did it all these different ways, but eventually I'm now more of a big book fourth step person. You know, I love the four-column format, and I break it down and I say, who, why, what, and my. So who is it that I'm resentful or fearful of? Why am I resentful or fearful of them? What is it affecting? And then my part, you know? And to me, if I'm having like a weird experience in the middle of the day and I can do who, why, what, and why, I can do that really fast. I can't do 95 questions really fast. You know, so I like the big book format, but the 95 questions really helped me kind of drill down and look at patterns. It looked at patterns of selfishness, anger, self-abuse, neglecting other people, a lot of patterns around fear. Like I said, my life was basically all about fear. So one of the cool things about, as I mentioned earlier, the fourth step is seeing these patterns, right? Because now that they're on paper, there's something about writing something on paper for me that makes it concrete, and it is a hell of a lot harder for me to be in denial about it because I just wrote it down. And if I really honestly wrote it down, I can't kind of go, oh, that's not true, you know, because I just wrote it down. So unless I'm fooling myself. And then once I share it with somebody in step five and get their objective feedback, you know, then I can start to use 6, 7, 8, and 9 to change my patterns. And so my lovely step five story is that this man listened to me for several hours, and he never flinched, and I thought it was great. And at one point, he stopped me, and I was talking on and on and on about being selfish. I'm selfish about this, I'm selfish, I'm selfish, I'm selfish. And he's like, okay, wait a minute. When were you first told you were selfish? Like, by who? And I was like, my parents. And he was like, how old were you? I was like, 9 or 10. And he said, and what is a 9 or 10-year-old like? And I thought for a moment, and I was like, selfish? And he's like, yeah, and he had kids, so he knew. I didn't know. He's like, 9 or 10 year olds, that's their world. And I'm like, so you're saying that I took on a judgment from my parents and made it my own belief about myself? And he was like, absolutely. And suddenly I realized there was a huge difference between self-care and self-centeredness. And that I was always wanting to take care of myself, but calling it selfishness and thinking I was being self-centered because that was the message I was getting. How would I know any different? I had nobody to teach me otherwise until this man lovingly pointed out that there was a contrast there. There was a discrepancy, you know. As some people say, there was a bug in the code, you know, and I need to reprogram my programming. So that for me is step five. And once I have all that out on paper with my higher power, telling it to another person, then I can use 6 and 7. And for me, 6 and 7 are perspective steps. They're steps that say, all right, now you've dumped. Basically, you've just dumped everything that you could ever think of that you've ever felt, and you've shared it with another person, and you're probably kind of feeling, I don't know about you, but I feel a little raw after I do that, and a little tentative. But the sixth step says, like, really now, take a look at these things. And for me, I don't necessarily have to, like, sit down again and pore over the pages. What happens for me is that if I do an inventory on a particular issue or even do a full fourth step, the sixth and seventh steps just start happening naturally. Why? How? It's because I go out in the world and I slight somebody. Or I go out in the world and let's say I'm dealing with anger and I get pissed off. And all of a sudden, it's right there in my life, right? Why is this a spiritual practice? It's because I have to practice it every day. It's practical. It's right there in my practical everyday face. So when something comes up, then it's like I get to see, now that I've written it down, because I'm still a little disconnected from what I wrote down, the awareness comes up and I start seeing it every place in my life. Right? And that to me is step six, because that accelerates my willingness to have that removed. And I have a great sixth and seventh step story. I was still in Rochester, New York at the time, and I was dealing with the defect of being late. And every single thing in my life I was late for. Every meeting, 15, 10, 20, 15 minutes late. And it was killing me. I'd walk in and I'd be like, oh my God, I felt so bad. And if I got to share, I'd say, I'm so sorry I'm late. I'm so sorry I'm late. Blah, 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 blah. And I'd be late for things. And at the time, I also didn't even have a car at one point. And people would come and pick me up, and they'd be waiting 5 or 10 minutes for me. And of course, they were smart. They said, we'll pick you up at X time, you know, knowing that I'd be like 10 minutes late. So it would all work out. We'd get there. But all of a sudden, one day, I got to a meeting about 15 or 20 minutes late. I was seething. I was like so upset with myself. And all of a sudden, I realized that I was upset with myself. I'm like, why am I apologizing to the entire group when I'm the one hurting me? I'm not hurting the group. I mean, yeah, it's great if everybody's here when the meeting starts, you know, because then you have a container, you have that kind of group feeling, and it grows as the meeting goes on. But if somebody's late, like, whatever. And everybody else in the room, if I walk in late right now, you're not all going like, oh, what a schmuck, he's late. You're just going, oh, Greg's late. Oh, it's good to see him, or whatever. You know what I mean? But I'm the one walking in late, beating myself up, and I realize, why don't I just accept that I'm late? I am a tardy individual. That's just the way it is. You know, and as soon as I did that, I'd get there late, and I'd start getting pissed off again. I'd be like, no, you're supposed to be accepting this. So I would accept it, and then I realized, I regret being late. Right? So I took it out of needing to apologize to everybody else, and starting to apologize to myself. Like, ooh, I regret being late. And that is how the six and seven steps starts working. Showing me my pattern, because then I actually had serenity around it. I was like, okay, I regret being late. I'm hurting myself by not making it to the meeting. I missed the prayer at the beginning. I missed it when they read the steps and the traditions. Back east, we always did that. And I'd missed the first share, or I'd missed the speaker, or whatever. I regret it. But you know what? Half a meeting is better than no meeting. So if I'm going to be late, I'm going to be late. Then the cool thing is, one day I was getting ready for my friends to pick me up at this time when I had no car. And I was sitting on the steps of the stairs inside the house, and I was waiting. And suddenly I realized that I was waiting for them. And I wasn't rushing, trying to brush my teeth and put my coat on or tie my shoes. I was waiting. And I was like, oh my God, it's been lifted. Like, I'm not late today. And really, all that matters is whether I was late that day. I was late again subsequent days, of course, because it's just the way it is, sometimes for me. But, you know, I grew up with a compulsive dad around that. He had to leave the house half an hour before we really needed to. He had to. And I grew up with a sister who was compulsively late. So I was stuck in between these two modalities, and I just chose to go with my sister because that seemed the easier way to go. But, like, the point I'm trying to make is that I couldn't be willing to have this thing removed until I accepted that it was actually there. If I'm fighting and struggling against it, there is no removal. I'm sorry. I could pray until I'm blue in the face. I could go to the greatest mosques and temples in the world and ask for this to be removed. But if I'm fighting it, I'm not doing the third step. I am not giving it over to the care of a power greater than myself. But so acceptance for me is so much a part of that, and really surrendering to the fact that I was late enabled me to begin to make changes. And that has always been the case for me. And so I don't really have enough time to really keep going with down the steps, but my personal opinion is that the first three steps they basically form a foundation of principles that then are repeated four more times. Right? And, but on deeper and deeper levels. So it's like step 10, continue to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Oh, look, repeated word. Admitted it, right? I admit something. This time it's not about food, because I did that when I got up this morning. I'm powerless over food, my life's unmanageable. I get on my knees, I say, God, please help me stay abstinent that day. I did it that day. I did it before I ate my dinner. I just exhibited impatience. I was doing that earlier this morning. I was driving from one place to another, and I was being impatient. And I was so impatient that every single car that got in front of me was slow. And until I could actually accept that I was going to be late, right, that late thing again, until I could actually accept that maybe I was supposed to go slow behind these cars and relax into it, then everything was okay. I stopped being stressful. I stopped feeling like compulsive about the traffic. It was great. And I was late. And you know what? My friend was fine with it. She got actually had a break. She had a break where she could actually learn a little bit more about her cell phone. So it's like, the thing is, it's like as soon as I lock my mind onto thinking that something has to be a certain way, usually Greg's way, as soon as I lock my mind onto thinking that, I completely close it to the opportunities to view other possibilities. There is no other possibility except my way. You know, that old phrase, my way or the highway. And it's really quite true. So this program helps me at deeper and deeper levels. You know, when I say step 10, continue to take a personal inventory, there it was, spot check. I was being compulsive around the traffic. I was being impatient. What happens after I'm impatient? I get pissed off. What happens when I get pissed off? I get resentful about the guy in front of me. And if I really, really latch onto that resentment, you know, then 2 days later, I'm still thinking about that guy in front of me, and I'm not being present with what's going on in the moment. And Lord only knows, but suddenly some strange piece of food that I wasn't intending goes in my mouth, right? And that's the way it works for me. And so the 11th step is connecting with that higher power. It's just further, it's furthering my coming to believe through the 11th step, right? And the 12th step is in my set. I don't know, it's, I guess it's, for me it's a combination of all the steps, but you could look at it in the light of the third step and say that by surrendering my self-fulness and to be of service to another person, I'm kind of putting myself, I'm kind of enlisting under God's service, so to speak, to be helpful to other people. So, let me go on and on about that. What it's like today, I really left no time to talk about that. But I think I've talked about it a lot in reality. I want to tell you a little bit about what I do on a daily basis, because this really helps me. Every morning, unless I'm willful or forgetful, and I have to throw that in there because that does happen, I get on my knees and I say the first three steps and the sixth and the seventh step. And the way I say it is, I say it as we hear it in the meetings. So I'm on my knees and I say, we admitted we were powerless over food and that our lives have become unmanageable. And then I say, God, I admit that I'm powerless over food, people, places, and things, and my life is unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. God, I believe that you are that power, that you and you alone can restore me to sanity, and I wish for you to do so. Please restore me to sanity today. And I need to do this every day, because even if I wake up feeling sane, that sanity can go out the window in an instant. Because I have an emotionally rich life. That's why. You know, and then the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to power granted ourselves. So over the care of, yeah, whatever, however it says. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And then I see the third step prayer as it's written in the big book. And to me, that even if I do all that completely insincerely, if I do that in the fastest rush that I have ever been in because I can't wait to eat breakfast or get out the door or I want to exercise or whatever my excuse is, I have found that time over time, no matter how insincere I am in doing that, if I do it, I am granted the gift of abstinence that day. And that's just been proof. Because when I relapsed, when I left the program in 94, I thought I could do it on my own, and I stopped getting on my knees, I stopped reading literature, I stopped sponsoring, I stopped having a sponsor, I stopped going to meetings, I stopped doing everything except meditating, and thank God, because that was the one tether that kept me to any sense of sanity. And next thing I know, I was having cookies every Friday. I was exhibiting binge eating over the weekend, which I had never exhibited, like massive quantity. the other things I do is I read some literature in the morning while I have breakfast. I meditate at least 15 minutes, sometimes longer, every day. And if you haven't meditated yet in program, I'd be happy to talk to you later about it. It's not that hard. It is scary, but it's not that hard. And it has been essential for me making that conscious contact, and particularly getting in touch with my intuition, because I really believe that my intuition is how God speaks to me. If I'm driving down the road stressing about the traffic, I can't hear that little, still, calm but strong voice say, take the next left. Right? Or if I'm completely obsessed about what I'm going to say to this woman, if I want to ask her out, I'm not actually listening for what could be more natural and what could be more organic and might actually be flirtatious or something instead of controlling. You know? So my whole gig now is that I allow my desire to have the best life that I can have to pull me through the steps. And at first I was pushed because I didn't want to be in the food. But now because I want spiritual progress and because I have dreams and I have hopes and I have goals, now those are pulling me through. You know, so I'm no longer being pushed or running with the food always behind me. I'm feeling like God in front of me. And they're actually both there. But the last thing I want to say is I'll just close with this phrase that I heard. And I haven't said this in a long time. And I heard this in an AA meeting once. And make sure I can remember it right because it's really cool. So a lot of people would introduce themselves and say, "Hello, I'm Greg. I'm a grateful recovering compulsive eater," right, or whatever. And I realized, like, yes, I am a grateful recovering compulsive eater. And by the way, I say compulsive eater because I exhibit control over the food as well as overeating. So I can go either way. So for me, it's just compulsive eating. It's not overeating. They don't say they're compulsive overdrinkers. So they're alcoholics. So I am a grateful compulsive eater, but I'm grateful to be recovering, and I'm also recovering to be grateful. Right? So there, it puts a sense of purpose there for me. It's not just to be clean from the food, because when I came in and I realized I had a food problem and I had a weight problem and I was definitely a compulsive overeater, I realized that it wasn't enough to just not eat. Because if I could have just not eaten, I wouldn't have needed to be here. So for me, I needed to replace the food with something else more positive. I couldn't replace it with a negative. I couldn't replace it with a not, don't do that, just go to meetings and don't eat. I had to replace it with what I said earlier, which was that I commit to feeling my feelings no matter what. And I'm really grateful to have been here today. Thank you for helping me stay out.